Classical musicians have a joke when asked to play something on the spot. It starts with, "Sure, I would like to play John Cage's 4 minutes and 33 seconds for you." The joke, of course, is that there are no instruments in the piece, unless we want to argue over what constitutes an instrument. The music calls for the performer to be silent for the entire length of the performance. But is the piece silent? Here's a clip from NPR's All Things Considered discussing the 1952 premiere of the piece by pianist David Tudor at the Maverick Concert Hall in New York.
Tudor starts a stopwatch, sits down in front of the piano, closes the lid, and begins a performance that sounds something like this. After 30 seconds of silence, Tudor resets the stopwatch and times another 2 minutes, 23 seconds of silence, then another 1 minute, 40 seconds of silence. But is it silence? In the Maverick that night, one could likely hear the sound of the breeze in the trees, rain pattering lightly on the rooftop, the chirruping of crickets, a dog barking aimlessly somewhere in the distance, the sound of bodies shifting their weight on creaky pine benches, the sound of breath being drawn and being expired. This was music for John Cage, and unlike compositions designed to make the outside world fall away, here was a music that, when it engaged you, made the present world open up like a lotus blossoming in stop-motion photography.
Think about what silence means to you. For example, right now, I'm listening to the dryer humming on the other side of my office wall, the fan under my laptop is blowing, and there's a constant low-level ringing in my ears from playing instruments and going to loud concerts since I was in high school. Sounds are always there. But there may be moments when nobody's expecting something from me. Maybe moments when I have the house to myself, no unexpected noises. Except maybe my 15-pound cat jumping off the kitchen counter when he knows he's not supposed to be up there. No demands, except perhaps the cat again wondering why I haven't fed him. Just peace and, well, not silence. I guess this is why we say peace and quiet, not peace and silence. But even in these moments, we have internal noise. You know that voice in your head that says, "Don't forget to pay the electric bill," or "Don't leave food on the kitchen counter because of the cat." Seriously, my cat. My point is that noise is always there, internally and externally. You might ask, what does this have to do with sociology? Surprisingly, this idea of silence is regulated by institutions in society. We often don't think about how external and internal noises are controlled by laws and norms. Today, sociology is going to ruin silence. See what I did there? My first apartment was in Vista, California, a city's not far from Oceanside, which some of you might not know has a large military presence due to its proximity to Camp Pendleton. There were a lot of late night parties in my apartment building, a lot of guys walking around shouting and drinking at all hours. Oh, and I forgot to mention, the building was right next to the 78 freeway. I'll admit that at night, freeway sounds aren't much different than having a white noise machine lulling you to sleep. But there are major issues with living near freeways. Researchers have focused on air pollution and the resulting respiratory illnesses in residents living near major thoroughfares. That issue gets a lot of attention because the effects are much more obvious. But then there's also noise pollution. Since this type of pollution is measured in terms of the effects on the human ear, the scale is referred to as A-weighted decibels, or dBA. According to an article by Ron Shepisuk in the journal Environmental Health Perspectives, a busy freeway at 50 feet is around 80 dBA. For comparison, a chainsaw can reach 110 dBA. Anything exceeding 120 dBA without hearing protection has the potential to cause physical pain. The most common effect of continued exposure to noise is hearing loss, or the tinnitus I described in the intro. But the problems don't stop at hearing loss. According to Shepisuk, other effects of noise pollution include elevated blood pressure, loss of sleep, increased heart rate, cardiovascular constriction, labored breathing, and even changes in brain chemistry. In other words, constant noise is bad, so don't live near major thoroughfares. But freeways, highways, toll roads, interstates, all of these are good examples of how institutions regulate the amount of noise in our lives. Ask yourself these questions. Why do people live next to freeways? And who decides where to build freeways? Last year, Los Angeles Times reporters Liam Dillon and Ben Poston conducted an investigation of 22 highway projects across 5 states and found that the projects to build, expand, widen those highways disproportionately affected residents in Black and Latino neighborhoods. The article focuses on people displaced by these projects, but on an episode of the podcast Gimme Shelter, which Liam co-hosts, he asked Alex Contreras, who uses they-them pronouns, about what it was like for their family to live next to a freeway.
Noisy. Very, very noisy. From what was been told to me, very noisy. It's the same thing that I grew up with, basically. I grew up in Downey next to a freeway. It's noisy. You hear weird noises all the time at all hours of the day. Definitely the air, if you're more sensitive to that. If you have asthma or you're more sensitive to have respiratory issues, it got worse. You could feel it in your body. Also, cleaning up became much more difficult to do. Everything gets covered in a fine layer of like dust. It's black dust, and it's coming from brake particles and all these other pollutants that gather that just sort of sprinkle out over the neighboring areas.
I highly recommend listening to that episode of Gimme Shelter. I'll link to it in the show notes. The regulation of noise goes beyond living next to car infrastructure. Think of rules regarding quiet hours in your neighborhood or apartment building. Think of living on the bottom story of an apartment building and hearing your upstairs neighbors clomp around at all hours because the developers use cheaper materials. Think about hospitals and how they're supposed to be places of rest and recovery, but instead patients listen to constant noises from equipment. And I haven't even touched on internal noise, the noise that reminds you of all the things you have to do because the idea that multitasking is normal has embedded itself in our work culture. Exhausted yet? We talk about health as a human right. It's the life part in our rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness in the Declaration of Independence, right? But what about silence? If noise is so destructive to people in society and closely aligned with our health, shouldn't we have a right to silence as well? I spoke to two people who believe silence is fundamental to healing society in many different ways.
Hi, my name is Justin Talbot-Zorn, and I've served as both a policy advisor and strategist and a meditation teacher in the U.S. Congress. I'm a writer and I'm an advisor to a variety of organizations working in public policy, environmental policy, and this book, Golden, The Power of Silence in a World of Noise, came out with HarperCollins in May of 2022.
And I'm Lee Mars, and I'm a collaboration consultant and leadership coach. I work with a lot of different initiatives, training and experimental mindset at NASA for several years, and working with a bunch of cross-sector groups to remove toxic chemicals out of our products. And also a longtime student of pioneers and researchers in the ritualized use of psychedelics in the West, and a dance teacher and a bunch of other fun things in Berkeley, California. I think that covers it.
Great. Well, thank you for joining the podcast. Can you give a summary of the book and what you learned from writing it?
Sure. Yeah, the book really came from a feeling of despondence we had about the state of the world around 2016, 2017. And asking ourselves the question, you know, what can we possibly do to bring a little bit more sanity to this crazy world right now? Having tried so much in politics and seeing so much failure and disappointment and, you know, two steps forward, at least one step back. And we both felt this intuition that a prerequisite to really bringing more clarity and connection and equity and sustainability to our world, a prerequisite would be to get beyond the noise, not just getting beyond the distraction, but actually tuning into silence, actually looking for answers in silence. Yeah. So we wrote an article about this idea for Harvard Business Review, and we were surprised. The article really resonated and really went viral, and we took that as a signal to keep studying this issue.
Yeah, that we had just been introduced. And so this was all a bit of an experiment. And after that article, we took a few steps back, but decided, you know, this was well worth pursuing, this inquiry, this tuning into silence at this time and place when we were both so overwhelmed. So we started just doing interviews, and it was delightful, asking all kinds of people, neuroscientists, politicians, artists, activists, a man incarcerated on death row, a whirling dervish, Lieutenant Air Force Colonel, all sorts of folks who had a deep relationship with silence. We asked them, what's the deepest silence you've ever known? And it was really their answers that pointed us in the direction that really shaped the book, where those answers were not, often were not auditorily quiet at all, and expanded our own inquiry on silence. And so they pointed us towards births and deaths and moments of awe and moments running the perfect line through Roaring Rapids or the 4 a.m. mark at a dance party, their way to quiet, and really helped shape the book so that we could look at this for individuals, for family members, for coworkers, and for society as a whole.
Being a sociologist, I'm interested primarily in society, in institutions, and how they play a role in our lives. In the book, you talk about how society has become louder, creating both this internal and external noise. And some of that is technological change, right? We all carry these devices in our pockets that vie for our attention constantly. But you argue that overall group norms and culture also drive noise. And the immediate example I can think of is multitasking, right? Research has shown our brains simply don't work that way. But work culture tells us that we can solve several problems at once efficiently. And maybe we just need the right project management software, right? How can silence help us push back on these narratives?
Yeah, it's a really good question, Matt. You know, we look at the book about how as a culture, as a society, we often mistake feelings of stress for aliveness. We often assume that the answers to every problem we're facing is more thought, more talking, more dialogue. And what we explore in these conversations with neuroscientists, you know, as well as extraordinary people working in social justice movements, artists, all sorts of people in all sorts of life situations, is that the answers to the most challenging problems often come from beyond thinking or talking. So it's like, why is our society so caught up in this, you know, mistaking stress for aliveness, mistaking more sound and stimulus for wisdom? You know, we look at Cal Newport, the computer scientist, looks at a really mundane example of, you know, group emails at companies, you know, and he reckons that those group emails, they might cost any small to medium-sized company or organization tens of thousands of employee hours of valuable thought and attention every year. But the underlying assumption is that if those emails occasionally make it easier to access information, then of course they're worth it. So Cal Newport calls this a kind of convenience addiction. You know, he says, because we lack clear metrics for these behaviors' costs, we can't weigh their pros against their cons, and any evidence of benefit is enough to justify continued use. So looking at how there's so much more, we look in the book at how there's so much more auditory noise in our world and point to the empirical evidence of that, but also orders of magnitude more informational noise in our world. And there's evidence that there's also orders of magnitude more internal noise. You know, so there's the auditory noise in our ears, the informational noise in our screens, the internal noise in our heads. And we're living in a society where we assume this kind of notion that more sound and stimulus, more mental stuff is always better. Any evidence of benefit justifies continued use. So the proposition in this book we make is that we can measure progress and productivity in ways beyond sound and stimulus. Like, what if we looked at pristine attention as a public good, as a shared good? And we could get a little bit more into what that means for the economy, as well as organizations and our individual lives.
Yeah, I like how you both mention in the book that the way we measure the economy, you know, productivity, and it's all based on certain things, but it doesn't take into account happiness or wellness of workers or citizens or any of that. I found that really interesting.
Yeah, we look at how in the way we measure GDP, if you chop down a forest, you know, to sell the lumber at Home Depot, then that counts as a plus according to GDP. But if you leave a pristine forest intact, then that doesn't, you know, demonstrate any benefit according to our foremost measure of social progress these days, GDP. But you could say the same thing about human attention. If you chop up human attention and turn it into eyeballs on a screen, you know, for Facebook to maximize ad revenue, then that counts as a plus for GDP. But if you preserve human attention, pristine human attention, enjoying a piece of art or playing with your children or being immersed in nature, just listening to bird songs, you know, those activities are likely to produce the most in terms of human well-being. And yet they don't count as anything according to GDP. So what if we measure the value of silent attention in GDP?
What's coming to mind is actually to share those words by Robert F. Kennedy that he spoke in 1968, really looking at that headline indicator of our societal progress. He says, "It counts air pollution and cigarette advertising and ambulances to clear our highways of carnage. It counts special locks for our doors and jails for the people who break them. It counts the destruction of the redwoods and the loss of our natural wonder in chaotic sprawl. It counts napalm and counts nuclear warheads in armored cars for our police to fight the riots in our cities. It counts Whitman's rifles and Specs knives and the television programs which glorify violence in order to sell toys to our children. Yet the gross national product does not allow for the health of our children, the quality of their education, or the joy of their play. It does not include the beauty of our poetry or the strength of our marriages, the intelligence of our public debate, or the integrity of our public officials. It measures neither our wit nor our courage, neither our wisdom nor our learning, neither our compassion nor our devotion to our country. It measures everything, in short, except that which makes life worthwhile."
Yeah, this leads me to one of my questions. So you make some policy recommendations in the book. I think there are five of them. Invest in public sanctuaries, assess new technologies for benefits, improve the economic measurements to reflect our wellness, enshrine a right to attention, which you mentioned briefly, Justin, and institutionalize this consensus-based decision-making. And when I think about the mechanisms behind these problems and what you just spoke of regarding how we measure the economy, they all seem rooted in this economic framework deeply embedded in our society and culture. And, you know, libraries are sanctuaries of silence, but they don't make money and are underfunded. Tech companies push out products with little to no oversight because they're constantly figuring out how to monetize our data. So, and the research into apps like Facebook and how they affect our mental health, as one example, that doesn't come out until we've been using them for years. So is there a political or even social will to reverse course? I mean, can we give up noise, essentially?
It's funny. I do think there is a political will in this country, at least, but it's not necessarily reflected in the policymaking ideas and preferences of political leaders at this point. I mean, whether you're looking in the left or the right, you know, on the left, concern about accountability for for-profit corporations and the attention economy, some of the work that the Center for Humane Technology and other watchdogs have been doing, I think there's a strong appetite to create new mechanisms to turn down the noise. But you also see this in how you see right-wing politicians railing against social media. Sure, a lot of the time you see Ted Cruz and Josh Hawley and people like that attacking social media companies because of concern about, you know, censoring Donald Trump or whatever their issue might be. But I think what they're also speaking to is this concern among a lot of the kind of conservative religious population that the society has become unmoored from traditional values because of social media and the attention economy and, you know, the loss of human attention. You know, that's really happened with some of these changes. So I do think there's a surprising degree of bipartisan agreement on this. It's just not being reflected in policymaking. So what could that actually look like if we had some agreement that we need to be thinking about the value of pristine human attention? You know, one thought, we look at the example, we have a section to what you just mentioned in the toward the end of the book on public policy ideas. And one of those ideas, as you just mentioned, is what we call innovate like the Amish. And there's a kind of misnomer that Amish people have a just knee-jerk negative reaction to any new technology, when that's not actually true. It's just that they have an extreme system of cost-benefit analysis, a really high degree of focus of cost-benefit analysis on any new technology. So if there's a new technology like a cell phone that comes on the scene, the Amish don't just say, okay, let's start using cell phones. Someone in the community has to ask the elders in the community for permission to try out the new technology. And then it's usually the person who asks will become the first adopter. Then the whole community pays close attention to how the technology is affecting that person's life. You know, is it making their work more efficient? Is it healthy? Is it making them self-centered? Is it negatively impacting their personality and their work ethic? Like, is it making them a mean and selfish person? And then after the whole community has had an opportunity to contribute their thoughts, then the elders will make an assessment. So obviously the Amish are a little bit more extreme with this than, you know, than we're ever likely to be. But the principle is they start with their own values as a culture. They look at their values, like that's community cohesion and humility and a strong work ethic. And then they consciously ask a question. Is this new technology going to be a net positive? Is it going to produce real benefits according to these values? And if the answer is yes, then they'll adopt the new technology. So we look in the book, like, you know, why, for example, don't we have an FDA that runs clinical trials on social media innovations like the like button that, you know, might seem it might seem benign, but actually have tremendous implications for the mental health of young people in particular that we're only just beginning to understand. So why can't we innovate just a little bit more like the Amish?
One thing we point towards is how one can innovate in their own lives, whether that's just as individuals, just finding their way to quiet, which one of the people we spoke with, Professor of Biobehavioral Health and Medicine, Joshua Smythe, said, quiet is what we think quiet is. So it's what we experience quiet to be. And those can be things that are by oneself sitting quietly, or they could actually be quite raucous and loud in a dance class, for example, where we're finding internal quiet in a loud environment. And so for our readers to kind of tune into what that quiet is and where they want to experiment and play in their own lives and perhaps in their family friend groups, and where this quiet could be of service to the work we do in the world, which there is often a default in our workplaces toward, and many people tell us that that's defaulting towards noise, defaulting towards more content, more meetings, more, you know, this, you know, more packed agendas. And what that really encourages is conventional thinking. It really encourages the tyranny of the fastest and the loudest, contributing to a thought process, which means we're not doing our best thinking. And so can we question the default? Can we look at those norms in the workplace? Can we kind of bring into the foreground the benefits of finding time for quiet reflection, whether it's in brainstorming, idea generation, or retreats, our day-to-day schedules, things like that? That's what we're interested in, as well as the big policies and society efforts we can make. So there is a tension here of that which we actually might have a little control over in our own lives, and that which is a little bit bigger and more unwieldy, but still needs our attention.
Yeah, you talk in the book about flow. I think a lot of us, and for those listening who don't know the concept of flow, and unfortunately, I'm not going to try to pronounce the psychologist's name.
Oh, I can do that for you. Yeah. Mihai Csikszentmihalyi.
Yeah, okay.
Mihai Csikszentmihalyi. Yeah.
I've read the books, but I always fail on pronunciation. And so flow is this, I don't know if you want to describe flow briefly, but we've all kind of experienced it in a way. I find it when I'm writing, where my brain just kind of goes into, it's hard to experience internal silence, as we all know. But when you're in this state of flow, you're only thinking about whatever you're doing at the time. And it's amazing. I don't know if you want to talk about that briefly.
I can start us off there. So that's exactly what's happening. Basically, our attentional networks are maxed out. There's only so much we can focus on. And what falls away to our pleasure and enjoyment is the space for self-referential thought. The ability for us to tell ourselves stories about ourselves or be so self-conscious about what's going on for ourselves as the main character. So all of our attentional capacities are needed for this task, whatever it is. So say it's writing or it's dancing, it's in movement or whatever. And so that's what's going on, that focus, that flow. So that's what we like to connect with is an internal quiet. And that's a very universal experience, it turns out. Csikszentmihalyi's studies were vast and just looked at people all over the world who had some version or different word or something to describe this state. So that's what we love about it. It's not something esoteric. It doesn't require us believing in a certain religion or to be alone or be still. There's a lot of expressions of flow, including micro moments, even just doodling and things like this, reading. We can get into flow states and all kinds of states. What's happening in the brain is fascinating there. And there's some common elements in what's happening in the brain in flow states and in moments of awe and in deep meditation, if we find that there, or in expanded states of awareness brought about with plant medicines and entheogens, mystical experiences. So there's this overarching commonality, and that's what we found fascinating in this process.
Yeah, I think everyone who listens to this can probably think of one moment which they entered that flow state. And like you said, it could be a variety of things. In the book, you talk about a young man who plays basketball and how he gets into a flow state and can perform exceedingly well on the court. But as soon as that inner monologue starts, that's when the flow state is interrupted and he finds himself performing poorly in the game. And so, yeah, I think a lot of people can relate to that. So I'm interested in this duality of silence regarding social justice. I know I'm kind of flipping to a different subject here. In the book, you talk about the oppression of silence, the idea that institutions or groups can pressure people to remain silent when they witness an injustice. But you also talk about the benefits of silence in conflict, like in the Quaker tradition, where it's encouraged to pause before making decisions, to kind of let those thoughts pass through. Sometimes it's really clear when we should speak up, but I think many of us struggle with when to break the silence in a conflict. How do we find that balance?
Totally. You know, in this book, we honor the idea that there is a kind of silence of complicity, complacency, or even silence as violence. You know, we certainly respect and appreciate that perspective. And, you know, for us as people who've been working in social justice, in various different fields and movements for decades now. I mean, this is something that we want to align ourselves with. And yet, we've come to an understanding that the silence of closed-lipped complacency, as we call it, isn't the deepest form of silence. It's not always the true meaning of silence, you know, because the refusal to perceive and address injustices, what's wrong in the world, that's the opposite of clear perception and intention. You know, when our eyes and our hearts are open and we have the space in our consciousness to really get beyond the distractions and pay attention, then we're not going to be satisfied to be apathetic and look elsewhere. We write in the book that the silence of apathy is a function of fear, and that a noisy world like enables injustice. You know, if we're too caught up in thinking about our Instagram likes and reality TV stars or socially unproductive profit seeking, it's like, how can we really understand the inequities and address them? If we're just thinking about our own inner chatter, that internal noise, then how do we have the internal space that's necessary for practicing empathy, for connecting with what's beyond our own skin? So we do this work of kind of reframing the meaning of silence in social justice in this book, looking to examples. We look to a lot of different examples of the place of silence in social justice, including in very difficult times, and how Gandhi, even during the whole Indian movement for independence, had every Monday in silence. He sometimes attended conferences and saw visitors, but he didn't speak a word. He said that a seeker after truth has to be in silence. So we look at this tension and we honor this tension and we have fun with it. You know, and you mentioned the example of the Quakers. And yeah, Lee, do you want to speak to this a little bit?
Yeah, the Quakers teach us really about threshing, that is really discerning the wheat from the chaff. And the practice there of that deep collective listening, where silence is really magnified when it's shared in this way. And so is truth, is what Quakers have found, truth. And so we speak with a birthright Quaker, Rob Lippincott, who tells us of being in like a really contentious meeting where they're using silence to help find that clarity in this difficult decision they're making as a group. And when things do get really, when people, it feels like people are maybe getting entrenched in their opinions and not budging and not open to influence any longer, and maybe the conversation is not rising and elevating in any way, the clerk in that meeting, there's a person who's attuning to that. They will call for a moment of silence. And that's a place or a time where he tells us he can kind of get reconnected to the purpose of the meeting, why it's important to find resolution, and his lifetime experience of that resolution coming through the silence. So he says, oh, you know, get a little quiet down a bit. And he'll, when we go back to speaking, someone will share just a brilliant synthesis of kind of directing them into a new path of thinking that's like what he wanted in the vein of what he wanted, but he wasn't really able to quite get there. So the intelligence comes through in that silence, and they are the masters of that. And they are also the masters of really knowing when it's time to speak truth to power and come from that place of discernment. And we turn to them quite a bit in the book, learn from them.
Is there anything in the research about this concept of, I know this is another experience that I'm sure we can all identify with, where we're in a moment, it could be a conflict, it could be you're working on something, you probably have too much internal, external noise to make a decision, and you walk away from that moment, you could go for like a run, you could go meditate, you could go get a cup of coffee, and suddenly everything hits you. And is there research, is there a link there with that, what the brain is doing as you're actually quieting down?
Yeah, you know, the research on what's happening to a brain in silence, it's a really new area of exploration for the most part. There's some researchers at Duke Medical School who looked at the effect of listening to silence, actually being in silence and listening to it in a mammalian brain, that more than any other type of auditory stimulus, more than classical music or other sounds, it stimulates the growth of neurons in the hippocampus, the region of the brain most associated with memory. So there's that kind of, you know, biophysical level to it that is just beginning to be understood. And there's other research that looks at similar findings. But a big part of the research that's happening now, particularly related to what you're talking about, of being in a high stress, tense environment where we're kind of straining to find the answer or to deal with a conflict, and then we step away from it into that spaciousness, there's research now around what's called self-transcendent experiences. And this is usually where we leave the parts of the brain that are called the default mode network, the prefrontal cortex and the posterior cingulate cortex, that are most associated with the sense of self, the sense of ego, the sense of how do I look at this moment? How am I performing when compared to others? How am I feeling in terms of my self-confidence? As opposed to being in a question, being in the present moment, being in an encounter with another person. So what we found in most of our research with neuroscientists and academic psychologists is that most experiences of transcendent creativity, but also generative problem solving, tend to come in these self-transcendent experiences when we're not all caught up in this, you know, in this me network of the brain, the default mode network, this noisy thoughts of self part of the brain. And we had some conversations with some neuroscientists and psychologists and psychiatrists that really changed our impression of how all this works. It was really fascinating for us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just a simple, pretty easy to apply in one's life is Judson Brewer, a newest scientist and psychologist, really just pointed us towards looking at that state of contraction. That's very like, oh, what's the answer? What's the word? What's the, you know, that state of contraction versus that state of expansion. So when we find ourselves in that state of constriction, can we notice what's happening in the body, what's happening in the mind? What are the types of thoughts that are going on there? And can we simply turn to expansion, to silence, to quiet, some interruption of that kind of that patterning? You know, get up and dance, go outside in nature, listen to the birds, listen to the leaves, listen to the wind, and take that hot shower, get that hot shower idea, insight moment that you know, all those things, all the things that I would venture to guess your listeners know about themselves, to really value that. That is real. So really to make time for expansion, especially as you notice that constriction is what's coming in. Simple practice that'll keep you busy your entire life.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me. This has been great.
Thanks for doing this. Thanks for having us. Really good questions.
Yeah, thank you.
So, is silence a fundamental human right? I hope this episode at least convinced you that social scientists need more research into how it's regulated. I'd like to thank my guests, Lee Mars and Justin Talbot-Zorn. This episode was written, mixed, and edited by me, Matt Sedlar. You can find me on Twitter @MattSedlar or the podcast @SociologyRuins. There was no music in the episode this week because, honestly, it was too hard to figure out if I could record an instrumental version of Enjoy the Silence without having to pay royalties. On a serious note, I'd like to dedicate this episode to my cat Goose, who sadly passed away while I was editing the audio. I'm gonna miss you, little buddy. Join me next month as Sociology Ruins Something Completely Different.